Hey, this is Nir Rakesh. You're about to hear a conversation I had with Dr. Joel Stein at a busy conference. He's the chair of New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia and Cornell's Rehabilitation Department. This is the first part of our multi-part series called The Road to Chair, which you can find anywhere podcasts are available under the Association of Academic Physiatry. Now, without further ado, on to the interview. I want to start kind of just way in the beginning about your initial training. Let's start with your undergraduate.
Sure. Good to go way back. So I was a computer science major, which may be sort of telling, at Columbia back when, you know, computers were still somewhat hand-wound and pretty simple. I was very interested in technology from a young age, I guess, is the lesson to draw there. I decided that that wasn't really going to be the focus of my career, and I decided to go to medical school. But my interest in technology really dates back to my undergraduate days.
Was there any like specific experiences that you had during engineering? And I'm saying this more, I also did engineering. Was there something that was an aha moment for you during undergraduate where you decided to choose medicine?
Sure. So just in full disclosure, I wasn't an engineering student. I was in the arts and sciences, but as a computer science major, sort of more in the math department than in the engineering school. That said, my aha moment was working over the summer for a computer software company. They were doing banking software. It was on mainframes. It was not, you know, personal computing. And I realized I missed the human contact of interacting with people, and I didn't like spending my day doing the technical aspect. So that was sort of my aha moment, if you will.
Makes sense. And then when you went to medical school, you were at Albert Einstein, is that?
That's correct. Yeah, Albert Einstein for medical school.
And then how did you end up choosing your initial residency?
So I initially followed an internal medicine residency. I did that at Montefiore, and I had a notion of maybe being a primary care physician. I didn't really have a clear vision for my career, honestly, at that point. So it was a little bit of a default decision for me. As I was doing it, I was a little frustrated by the feeling that I wasn't making people better in the way that I wanted to. Their lives weren't better. They would come into my clinic or in the hospital, I would make a diagnosis, I would give them medications, but they weren't able to do anything the next day that they couldn't do the prior day or feel better. Treating their diabetes, treating the hypertension wasn't as satisfying as I hoped it would be.
Interesting. And then I think this is probably a little bit foreign to most of the residents nowadays. You did an internal medicine residency, and then you decided on doing a rehab residency after that. Does that tie into where you didn't feel that you were kind of, I guess, treating patients as you thought you would? Did rehab offer that? Or how did you end up on rehab?
Sure. Well, the short story is I ended up on rehab because my wife was in the field and she seemed much happier. So I said, gee, maybe I'm missing something here. So I did an elective. They allowed me to do an elective during my medicine residency. And I actually did it on an inpatient rehab unit at Columbia. Even though I wasn't a resident, I was able to do my elective there. And I loved it. I was using some of those medical skills that I had been working on, but I felt that I was helping people achieve more independence and more function, which was, of course, the essence of rehabilitation, but was something that I wasn't finding in internal medicine. So I actually decided during my medicine residency that I was going to do a PM&R residency and applied during my medicine residency. Could have actually started after my PGY2 year, but felt that I wanted to finish out the medicine program. So finished 3 full years of medicine and went straight into PM&R. Obviously, that's a pathway that was much more, you know, available in those days. These days, it's difficult to do 2 residencies because of reimbursement issues, which I think is actually kind of a loss for medicine broadly.
Do you find that the medicine helps you more now? Even looking back now, do you look at rehab in a different way, having had that training?
I think that, you know, any training and experience you have impacts your point of view to some degree. Absolutely, I certainly when I was more involved in inpatient rehab, it was a very clinically important piece of my sort of, you know, approach to patient care. I understood the medical issues at a level where I guess I felt, you know, a little more comfortable and able to manage a broader array of issues. In what I do now, you know, because I do more outpatient, I still use those skills to some degree, but probably less so than I once did.
Okay. And then when you were in rehab, what did you was there anything that you were taken away by immediately, or was it something that you were kind of just in the field, just experiencing and letting it wash over you, and then you just kind of went through?
So it was pretty clear from the outset when I started my residency that I really gravitated towards the neurologic rehabilitation. That was from day one, and it was really what drew me to the field. And inpatient in particular was where my initial interest was. I was quite confident I was going to do a spinal cord injury. you know, it just happened to be sort of what grabbed me, and I thought, gee, that would be great. And that was kind of my vision during residency. I never liked taking care of patients with back pain. and that remains a pretty consistent piece of my practice. I assiduously avoid taking care of patients with back pain in particular. But when I actually finished my residency and started looking for a job, the reality was that there were in the geographic region I was looking in, there weren't any spinal cord jobs, but there was a job doing stroke. So I said, okay, I'll try that.
So you really just fell into what you ended up doing. It wasn't that, it was just the jobs were available and that's what you ended up choosing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination. Obviously, there were a variety of jobs, and I had already narrowed my focus to some degree to neurologic rehabilitation, to inpatient. So in that sense, it wasn't just sort of, you know, completely random, but yes, it was my finding myself as a stroke person was to some extent unexpected and not really where I was, I thought I was headed.
And where were you exactly when you went for your first job?
So my first job was at Spalding Rehab Hospital, which...
it's not a bad place.
Well, yeah, that's actually very true. It's a wonderful place. now, at the time, interestingly, it was not yet an established PM&R department.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's hard to appreciate how much things have changed. But when I went there, there was no formal PM&R department. There was no residency program. The hospital was mostly run by internists and neurologists with a relatively small PM&R presence. Why I chose to go there in spite of that was that I perceived that there was an opportunity there to build something special and that people were committed to developing PM&R. As it turns out, that was a bet that paid off for the institution and for the field, I think, more so than for me personally. But it was a little bit of a gamble.
I can imagine. Do you attribute that going in and starting something new in an area where it's not really so easily kind of done, do you attribute that to a lot of your success having to go through that process? Or would you have preferred going to a place where everything was all set up and it was very easy to do?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I sort of enjoy that challenge, and I think... You know, in the field of PM&R, because of the limited awareness of our specialty among other medical practitioners sometimes, there are plenty of academic medical centers in the U.S. that don't have PM&R departments now and or are trying to build one or, you know, have a very limited presence. There are plenty of practitioners out there in related fields that are sort of unaware of what we do. So all of us, to some degree, in our professional lives in this field, have to do a certain amount of proselytizing and bringing the word out. You know, I did not go there with the thought of being an academician. So that may be a little surprising to hear, but so in that sense, my goals were really primarily clinical. I guess I had some notion about programmatic growth, but really it was mostly about clinical practice. I did want an environment that, you know, I thought was, I wanted a residency program. I wanted a place that was academic in that sense, but I didn't have a vision of being involved in research particularly or you know, sort of advancing in the academic track. It just wasn't something that was on my mind yet.
What was it, I mean, as you're going through your job, what was it that gave you that thought that I need to do something more than just what I'm doing? Did you start taking on more leadership roles? How did you get involved in that?
So I had gotten a little bit involved in research as a PM&R resident, not in a large way, certainly, small clinical projects, and it was fun. And when I settled into my new job, I started doing the same. I started getting involved in little projects because just something I thought would be interesting, more so than as a means to an end. And then at some point, I was invited to participate as a co-investigator in a rehab engineering project with some robotic folks at MIT. they were looking for a clinician with, you know, involved in stroke. And I said, gee, this sounds really interesting. And I got involved and I really began to appreciate the opportunities for further work in that area. So it was sort of a gradual process. I also became more involved administratively. I became involved in sort of hospital leadership roles and eventually became chief medical officer, which was really a, not an academic role, but very much an administrative role.
Oh, wow.
What was interesting about that, and please don't tell my administrator colleagues about this, but it afforded me a little more flexibility in my schedule, you know, in the sense that I could carve out an afternoon and get some work done.
Yeah.
In a way that's hard clinically. There's the demands of clinical practice make it hard to accomplish some of those academic tasks. So in some ways, I found that combination of administrative work with academic activity to be more congenial than trying to combine it with clinical work exclusively. The other piece of it was I found the clinical piece to be really enjoyable, but there was sort of a saturation point. At some point, it felt like I was just, you know, trying to keep up with the treadmill. I sometimes use the analogy of clinical work and being a fireman, because every day you go to work and you put out the fires.
Yeah.
And you go home, and then the next day you go back to work and there are new fires to put out. And there was sort of a lack of a sense of progress, of long-term goals. It was very much the day-to-day piece, and I missed the idea of having a longer-term goal, of having a project. And I found some of that administratively, and I found a lot of that on the research realm as well.
So you were just trying to figure out why the fires were even starting in the first place.
Yes, I guess you could say that. Or how to fight fires better in the future, right?
That's fair.
You know, this being rehab, it's all about the function. But it seems like we should have overarching goals that are longer term rather than simply, you know, dealing with today's problems right now in the here and now. Not that that's not important. And it's still something I enjoy. I see patients, you know, as a part of my work to this day. But I... if that were all I were doing, I think I would get a little frustrated. And I think some of the burnout issues that people experience may come from that sense of there's just an endless, it's like the old episode of I Love Lucy with the conveyor belt. It's a classic scene where she can't keep up with the conveyor belt. And that's how a lot of clinicians feel, that they just, no matter how hard they work, they still have to be on that treadmill and they're going as fast as they can to keep up.
Yeah.
And I think that both the administrative work that I've done and certainly the research work, not that it doesn't have its own challenges, but it doesn't have that same feeling of a treadmill. And I like the balance. I like doing some of the clinical, but some of these other pieces as well to give me a more diverse portfolio.
Makes sense. I want to tackle two things you said real quick, if we can go back. One, when you'd come in, you'd said you were kind of reaching out to all these departments, you were starting a new thing. What did you find was, would you attribute to your success to helping build the department at that time?
Sure, back at Spaulding.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, my largest contribution was probably doing a good job clinically. I think that every good clinician in the field, and this is broadly true, helps establish the credibility of the field and the specialty. We've sometimes had credibility issues and quality issues in PM&R as a field. It hasn't always attracted the very best of the people in medicine. It's always had great people, but it hasn't always been exclusively great people. And I think the idea of PM&R as, and this was more of a concern back in, you know, when I was starting practice, sort of a passive conduit to therapies rather than actively managing patients.
Yeah,
it was something that people, colleagues in other specialties questioned, you know, are these guys really doctors? Are they really able to manage their patients and do a good job as physicians broadly? And there's no substitute for doing a good job clinically to convince other people that we're an important and legitimate part of the medical profession. So the most important thing I think I did was to try and take good care of my patients.
It's definitely true for everything, I'd hope.
Right, I'd hope so.
And then the other thing was the research. If you look at all the research that you've done, a lot of it has to deal with stroke, which makes sense. But then the robotic aspect, was that just something that was just happening at the time and you got involved in and you found that it was fun? or was there something that ties back way to the undergraduate experience of dealing with computer science and that kind of that draw to the field?
Sure. So I have, long had this affinity for technology that persists. I just like technology for its own sake, and it's fun, it's interesting, and I'm comfortable with it. Some people, are less so. I have colleagues who, sort of are afraid of technology or shy away from it or find it, frustrating. And that's never been my perspective. I've always found it intriguing and seen the potential of it to help us. That said, my initial involvement was fortuitous, not by plan. I didn't get involved in I didn't go to the engineers to knock on their doors. They knocked on mine. But once I tasted it, I began to appreciate the opportunities to develop other collaborations with other engineering groups. And it wasn't just sort of a one-off for me. And I do find myself thinking in some, the good engineers think a little bit like doctors.
Yeah.
And the good doctors in this field think a little bit like engineers.
Huh.
Right. I mean, that's how you have good collaborations. They have to understand the clinical issues they're trying to treat, and we need to understand a little bit of the technical challenges, the capabilities, and the sort of the way they think about problems. And the longer I've been in this, the more I've been able to speak a little bit of their language, and certainly I've worked with people that have learned the medical language as well. Not that we have the same expertise, but we're able to at least communicate better with each other.
So is it impossible if you don't have that ability to discuss with engineers in their own particular language and they can't discuss with you, can we not get projects that's established? Or is it something that you gradually learn as a result?
Yeah, I mean, I did not learn any of this in my computer science. I mean, that doesn't come from that. This comes from, sort of listening and learning and not being sort of not putting on blinders and ignoring that. And, when they use terms, asking them what they mean. And it's important to understand what a degree of freedom is. It's a pretty basic thing in engineering, but it's not something they talk about in medical school.
Yeah.
Right?
It's
an engineering term, but once you start understanding that and you start thinking about, issues of motors, I've learned things about motors I never thought I'd need to know, but, there's a trade-off, right? You can make a motor fast, you can make a motor powerful.
Yeah.
But those things are to some degree, or you can make it small. But you can't have everything, right? There are trade-offs. If you want a small, powerful, fast motor, you want something that doesn't exist to some degree. Right?
Yeah.
So understanding those trade-offs allows you to have sort of more meaningful conversations with the engineers, even if you don't necessarily speak, can't speak to the equations.
Yeah, yeah. So let's fast forward a little bit.
Sure.
How is it that you go from Spalding to New Presbyterian Hospital? And was it something that you saw because you were here before? It was something you were comfortable with and you felt you knew the system well enough that you could make changes?
Sure. So, I was at Spalding for 16 years, which is a good long run.
Sizable.
It was fun. It was great. I felt like I, accomplished a lot there. But you start thinking what else might be out there, what other opportunities, what sort of leadership opportunities. And it came to my attention that there was the chair position at Columbia was open. And there's a certain romantic notion about going back where you trained in a leadership role to sort of, carry on the traditions, if you will, of your own training. So I was just intrigued. And I said, let me check this out. And I went and interviewed and realized that I had learned a lot, first of all, in 16 years, which was reassuring.
I hope so.
That the perspectives that, some of the perspectives that had been at Columbia when I left as a resident had changed, of course, and some were still, still sort of the culture had continued in some ways. And it was sort of exciting to come back from a new vantage point and see the opportunities, perhaps, that hadn't been fully realized there. And I saw the things that could happen that hadn't yet happened. So for me, it was almost like when I first went to Spalding, seeing the possibilities and hoping that I could help realize some of those possibilities.
So you're almost innately driven to find something where you can make a big change. It's not already done. It's not easy. It's you just kept taking steps where you saw something that was new and exciting that you could make a big change in. And that's how you made your decisions kind of throughout life.
Clearly, yes. I'm not sure that I was as aware of it, as self-aware as perhaps I should have been. But,
it's easy retrospectively.
Yeah, but clearly in the second, you know, this role, taking on the role of chair, clearly that was a major driving factor. It was this sense of excitement, of possibility. You know, it's sort of like if you want to achieve things, you have to pick the right opportunities, right? If you go to, you know, imagine you go to RIC, wonderful place, great place, right? Shirley Ryan Ability Lab. It's hard to have as big an impact in a place that's that well established.
Right.
As you can in a place that really isn't sort of, you know, it's much easier if things are in a difficult place or a more limited program than they are. You can do a lot more. There's a lot more running room, if you will, than a place where it's sort of hitting, you know, has a new building, has, you know, a tremendous staff and faculty, a great residency. It's harder to add to that place in a substantial way. So in that sense, yeah, that's part of what drove me to take this was I saw both, it wasn't where it could be, but I saw a path to get there. And that combination was very appealing.
Oh, I think it's obviously good to know that it's not someone in your place. It's not that you saw yourself there and that was the entire kind of overarching goal. It's just you're taking life step by step, and that I think is a very great insight to hear from someone like you, where all of us are kind of figuring our way through and not sure how to get there.
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, if I had to sort of summarize my path here, it was, you know, largely sort of reactive and opportunistic rather than based on a grand plan.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not maybe proud of that, but I think that, you know, that's how a lot of people end up in wherever they end up.
Yeah.
It's not rare to speak to other people in the field who have been successful in one way or another and realize after you talk to them that they never intended to do what they're doing now. But along the line, they fell in love with something, they found it interesting, they got excited about something, and they really dug into it, and that's how they achieved success.
That's awesome. So just kind of the parting wisdom at the end. For the residents, fellows, and medical students, if they're interested in research, but they have no idea kind of where to start or how to start, how early should they start? What should they do? What should they look out for?
Sure. So, you know, the message, of course, ironically, is don't do what I did. Do what I say. Isn't that always the way? And I think that it would have been much easier, and perhaps I would have accomplished more academically if I'd actually had a vision and had some guidance along the way rather than sort of finding my way. It's encouraging that you can still find your way, but you can actually accomplish more and more rapidly if you have a little bit more of a vision and some more guidance. So I would say if you're interested in research, you should get started right away. I think there's no reason to delay. And I think the real path to success is to get some way of having dedicated, protected time to really sink your teeth into your research program and activities to really define your interests, to really develop a good bit of momentum, and to learn the skills that you'll need to be successful in competing for extramural funding and advancing your program. So programs, you know, the variety of career development programs, the K programs, obviously the RMSTP used to have a K-12, it doesn't anymore, but there are plenty of other K awards that are given by the NIH directly. And fellowships, research fellowships that provide an on-ramp for people to really dedicate time to research and develop a program, that's the path to success. I think to try and do it on the fly as a full-time clinician, you know, I'll do it on the nights and weekends. It's not that it can't happen, but it's a much more difficult and less reliable path.
Makes sense. And you mentioned something that I found very interesting the last time you talked about this. I'll give you a scenario where a lot of people, especially residents, are looking at research and they're saying, I want to do a project that's in the field, it's specifically what I want to deal with. And that may not have the particular people that are the best mentors, but then you have these other projects. May not be something that you're interested in, but the mentor is amazing.
Sure.
How do you pick that? How do you differentiate the two when you're making that decision?
Sure. Well, I think it depends on, that is an issue to some degree of what stage of your career you're in. I think as a resident, a lot of people are trying to decide, is research something that really interests them? Do they enjoy it? Are they good at it? Do they want to do it later in life? And are maybe perhaps a little less in need of defining their definitive research area. So in that sense, I think having the right mentors and developing the right skills might be more important than having a project in the right area. You know, depending on where you are and what the resources available are. Look, it's great if it all aligns. That's ideal. And I'd encourage people, if they can find a project that very much fits with their clinical interests and their career direction, and they can find the right mentor, they should go for that. That may be outside of the PM&R department, and that's fine. People should look, you know, to orthopedics, to physical therapy, if there's a physical therapy school there, to neurology, to, you know, wherever the collaborators might be and the mentors.
Right.
So I think part of the trick is to look for the right mentors wherever they might be, not just within your own specialty. But I think having the right project and the right mentors at that early stage may be more important than being directly in your field of interest. And you may change your field of interest as a resident. You're not necessarily, you know, fully formed in that sense.
Right. And I don't know if this is a fair question, given everything that we've talked about. But if for advice for people that are interested in going into more of the academic routes, becoming program directors, or even chairmen or chairwomen, what do you have kind of for those people that are interested in that?
I think that in terms of the academic path, there's a temptation sometimes, a strong temptation, to take on administrative leadership roles very early, sometimes prematurely. And if you have an opportunity to develop your research program more in the early years, you can always pick those things up later. It's not as hard to move into the administrative piece a little later in your career track. But if you don't get the research piece going early, that gets harder over time. So if you have a choice, if you've got a few hours and you're trying to decide how to spend them, in the more junior years, I would say you really should try and find a way to do something that has a research focus. And then later on, you can become associate program director, you know, as opposed to the other way around, taking associate program director role or something, and then realizing you don't really have time for research because you won't have time later.
It's definitely the trend I'm learning. You get less and less time.
Correct.
As you go,
you're
going
to get busier
career.
In life, not less busy. So your best chance to get a research program started, and the what will distinguish you in the field of academic rehab medicine is to get a research program going sooner rather than later.
Makes sense. That's pretty much all the stuff. Is there anything else you have? Any nuggets of wisdom?
Enjoy what you do. You know, I mean, I think in the end, you have to pick things that really give you pleasure, because none of these things are going to prove to be 9-to-5 jobs. The research stuff, you know, we joke about, you know, all of our faculty get 2 days of protected time for research, Saturday and Sunday. yeah, that's not a very funny joke, maybe, but I think that the reality is it's hard to fit all this into a sort of conventional work week. And I think that's a challenge for, you know, life-work balance. That's a topic for another day. But I think that you have to have a certain passion for it. You have to really enjoy it to dedicate the energy to it. If you're not enjoying it, you shouldn't do it. You should find something that really speaks to you that way.
Makes sense. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure.
I appreciate all your time.
Of course.
Thanks for listening to our first episode of the Road to Chair series. I hope you enjoyed it and stay tuned for more to come.